I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. Brown is the color of my hair. Brown is the color of my lover boy stare. Color like a truffle with the hazelnut cream. Brown skin baby with the light skin dream. I was once told brown wasn't pretty for a lady. Had a parasol ever since I was a baby. Mama, she would tell me stop playing in the sun, but I loved to play rough and that wasn't no fun. My family from a region where the Spanish occupied, so my people light skinned over there, here's why. They mingled with the women, it was more like rape, so I got that Andalusia in my blood anyway. My cousins hella brown and they treat me real nice, cause they bronze and I'm tuned for every gold light. Philippine, Polynesian, Indonesian traits, but we all sailed in from Africa anyway. That's why you could travel all the way to my home, see a bunch of natives on the side of the road, sipping on that brown fire water in the palms. Just another loss of a brown skin god. I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'ma keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'ma keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'ma keep making more. I'll keep making more. If brown is wrong, I don't wanna be right. Jesus Christ, amen. I don't wanna be white. But every hero to the story, why they gotta be white? Think it's time everybody stop being polite. Only speaking on facts, it's all over the news. Another brown man dead over motherfucking shoes. Laughing to the bank while we murder our own. It's another form of brown population control. Open your eyes and maybe you find that we worship the sun since the beginning of time. And while these white girls tan and these black girls bleach, all my brown girls darker than a paper bag preach. To the melanin deficient, jealous how we live in, passing on the hate to our children. Stay blessed when your girl come around with the fist up. Revolution gotta stay brown. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm a brown skin lady with a brown skin baby, and I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm gonna keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm gonna keep making more. I'll keep making more. I'm gonna keep making more. I'll keep making more.
That was Brown Babies by Rocky Rivera. Welcome back to Radio Pawikan. I'm your host, Edna. For this week's episode, we interviewed Rohan, an activist from the United States. They are Black and Asian, so Blasian, and we'll be talking about Blasian March, a movement they started to combine both the Black Lives Matter and the Stop Asian Hate movements. Rohan also has Filipinx ancestry, and we're happy to welcome them in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's so amazing to be here. Hello, Switzerland and all my comrades out there.
Yes. Could you tell us a bit about yourself? Introduce yourself.
Yeah, of course. My name is Rohan Joly. And I am a writer, a dancer. My pronouns are they, them, and sha to honor my Filipino heritage. And I also use the pronoun ta to honor my Chinese heritage. I'm also an activist based in New York City. A lot of my work focuses on uniting Black and Asian communities through one, education on similar experiences with racism, and two, celebration of each other.
So you're here in Zurich because you performed at the Unite Festival and you're yeah. talking tomorrow at the Enough Action Days.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about what you did and what you're doing?
Yeah, so the day I landed here, I went straight to work. I was like, oh my goodness, this is life as an organizer. Wow.
Yeah.
the first night at the Unite Festival, I delivered some poetry. One of my pieces, I was asked to like write, it's called The Obsidian Wings of Heaven, and it's dedicated to the life and to honor the life of Nzoi. And then I also performed one of my other pieces, Two Sides of My Face, which is about the discrimination I face for being both Black and Asian. And then somehow I wound up on a panel, speaking at a panel on appropriation and racial injustice. So huge shout out to Lucas at Linke POC for bringing me over here, connecting me here. And then the second day I danced a ballet, contemporary ballet solo I choreographed, and it's called Homage. And it pays tribute to Asian Americans who've been killed by police. It's a topic that very few folks know about in the States or abroad. We're often taught that police brutality only happens to Black people in the States, when in fact it happens to literally everyone of color. And yeah, it's a difficult subject, but I think it was a way for me to raise awareness while still expressing myself as an artist. And yeah, tomorrow I will be speaking at the Enough Festival at 12 p.m. About my work with this organization that I founded called the Blasian March. And that's the sort of Black Asian unifying work I do.
I guess just to add quickly, Nzoi is a Black person here from Zurich that was killed by police a year ago in Morges, and there is a Justice for Nzoi campaign. Tell us a bit more about Blasian March.
Well, first of all, I thought it was going to be just this small one-time little protest, kind of in the thick of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020. So for folks who don't know, Black Lives Matter was a movement founded in 2013 during the Obama era by Opal, who is now Ayo Tometi, Patrice Cullors, and Lisa Garza, three Black women, majority of whom are queer. And it's a movement to basically affirm Black life wherever there is the oppression of Black people. So it can be policing, it can be economic justice, it can be environmental justice, all those things. So in 2020, for folks who still don't know, I think by now the world knows, but that was during the lockdown and the pandemic, and that was when Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, murdered George Floyd. And in New York, there was just a huge explosion of protests. Like, people be out every single day. You would see like thousands of people like taking major bridges, taking the streets.
I mean, even here there were protests. Yeah. It was like a huge thing.
Yeah. And it's something I have no idea if we'll ever see that again in our lifetime. Maybe in another lockdown, who knows?
Maybe during the revolution.
But in New York, you saw this like expansion of different kinds of Black Lives Matter rallies. So you would see like the Black Women's March, and that was to center Black women. You would see the Black Disabled Lives Matter March. There was the Stonewall protests, which were a weekly Thursday rally to honor Black, trans, and LGBT people. I think a lot of that came out because of the way Black Lives Matter as a movement has been, in my opinion, distorted by white media in a way that it has only centered a very specific narrative. If you've read Toni Morrison, she's a Black writer, and she has this concept called singular narrative. And that's like, for me, that means like there's only one storyline that is acceptable to like white supremacy and white culture. And in that aspect, the only story that is permitted or acceptable to Black Lives Matter is a story where a police officer kills a Black man, mm-hmm. which does not leave any room for Black women, Black queer folk, Black disabled people, Black immigrants, Black undocumented people, or people who are mixed like me, who are Black and Asian. you know, I'm thinking of Travis Jordan, who was a Black Asian also killed by police, and it didn't make big news because, once again, it's that kind of storyline where, you know, we are told that policing violence doesn't happen to Asians in any capacity. Mm-hmm.
They're the model minority, right?
Absolutely. And that was a term actually generated in white media around the same time as the development of the political identity Asian American. Like, it's clearly built on purpose to keep Asians in control.
And also to erase, I guess, the resistance of Asian Americans. Because, I mean, it's been there, you know? It's not something that never existed. There were the Asians that supported the Black Panthers, I think.
And then Richard Aoki, a Japanese American, was also involved in the party. But even before that, I'm thinking of, like, 1870s and the L.A. Chinatown Massacre, where they literally, like, mass lynched between 17 and 20 men who were Chinese. And this is the largest mass lynching recorded or known in U.S. history. Wow. And even thinking on top of that, in that area, Chinese people had to build underground tunnels to be safe at night from white people. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, wait.
That's crazy.
It's so wild because it's just like, this is so similar to the Black experience because we had the Green Book. And the Green Book was like a little book, that would give a list of, you know, sundown towns. And sundown towns were places you do not go to after night, or you have to be like indoors because they would kill you.
Yeah.
It's the same struggle. Different solutions, but it's the same treatment. At the time, you know, attending a lot of these rallies, I was really trying to make sure that people knew I was like a queer person. So I would walk around with like a pride flag, just in case people don't think it's obvious. And I was also pretty involved with some Asian organizing, which now, looking back, we know that was the earliest stages of Stop Asian Hate, another movement. But things kind of fell through. The way things were organized is not really how I organize. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to do my own movement. I'm going to do my own action. That'll be my healing process. And I'll also be, you know, a space where I can bring all my people together and give Asians permission to really march out for Black lives. Because I feel like often a lot of the Asians you would see in the organizing spaces would be like kind of in the background doing a lot of the like safety work, the logistics, you know, coordinating food support. And you would see, at least the rallies I went to, you would see a lot of Black folks being like, thank you to all of our white allies, our Latino allies, but no one ever say Asian allies. So I'm kind of just like, I'm glad that we're here, but participating in the invisibilization, the making invisible of Asians, is a white colonial practice. Mm-hmm. You know, the erasure of Asians from our history is a colonial practice. So all that kind of went into this first time rally. So I was like, yeah, like there should be a space where we can all come together. There should be a space for Black Asians like me in this movement.
Definitely.
Yeah. If Black Lives Matter, then Black Asians matter. And if that's a problem, then excuse me. So the first rally was October 11th, 2020. Which, fun fact, is actually during Filipino American History Month.
So October is Filipino American History Month. Yes,
It's to honor, I believe, the first time Filipinos set foot in the Americas. But it was also the anniversary of the murder of Jennifer Laude, a trans Filipina woman who was killed by the U.S. Marine Joseph Michael Pemberton, who was convicted, but his sentence was reduced because he did the whole, she was trans, I didn't know. This is sexual assault.
And I think there was also, it's just like a little bit of reading between the lines, but he was released early.
He was released early.
And shortly thereafter, the U.S. gave weapons to the Philippine army.
Yep. Yep. So all of our oppression is linked. But one thing I did find really beautiful was that a lot of folks now know about Jennifer Laude. A lot of Black folks now know who she was and this really awful, tragic story. And there was even a moment at the rally where a Black trans woman shouted out Asian Lives Matter, which, you know, some people find controversial because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I do think that certain mm-hmm. language belongs to certain political movements, and we should honor that. But I think if someone from that movement uses that language, if a Black person says that, like, what a beautiful show of solidarity. What a beautiful olive branch.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like Asian people just, I guess, yeah, appropriating
right.
the language, but someone offering it in
right.
a way.
Things that I took a long time to learn. Like in the moment, I was like, oh, we don't say that. But, you know. Mm-hmm. When Stop Asian Hate kicked off and I saw more Black people saying it, I was like, actually, no, like, that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Asian hate is something that has been ignored for a long time. I personally, at least in the U.S. context, was not really that aware of it. But I mean, of course, I'm quite far away.
That's okay. It happens here too.
But yeah, reading those stories and those articles that reached, you know, like global news about Asian people getting harassed during COVID, mm-hmm. telling them that they are the reason there's COVID. They're the reason they brought COVID to the States or to whatever country. That's like, wow, that was right. crazy.
Right. And it's so frustrating thinking about this is a pattern that's happened over and over again with the United States. So like, and one of my other colleagues who actually works at Stop AAPI Hate, and they are the main record database for all these incidences. And he pointed out how a lot of these waves of anti-Asian violence always pair up with US foreign policy. Mm. So like, we're thinking about the internment of the Japanese Americans and how that paired up with, one, obviously that was a U.S. policy, but the anti-Japanese sentiment that went around, or a lot of the Yellow Peril propaganda, which was like cartoons that were anti-Asian, anti-Chinese, anti-Japanese, even famous illustrators like Dr. Seuss had a lot of anti-Japanese Yellow Peril propaganda that paralleled a lot of anti-Asian violence, or the U.S. annexation of the Philippines, mm-hmm. and seeing a lot of the mass migration of Filipinos to the United States, and how, you know, they were called Filipino dogs. There is a very untold history of the lynchings of Filipinos, especially out in the West. Of the United States. So there's always this parallel. So, you know, a lot of people will think, oh, what Donald Trump, our former president, said, you know, calling it Kung Flu, China virus. This is a pattern. It's a cycle that, because we're not teaching this history, it's happening over and over again. You know, we're not naming it as this is the cycle and it needs to stop U.S. foreign policy or U.S. leadership, you know?
That's why we need these community organizers and people like you
that
do these, that Blasian March and BLM movement and just these movements in general, because we can't count on the people in power to help us when they're the ones that are actually like fanning the flames mm-hmm. of this kind of racism mm-hmm. with the kind of policies that they do all over the world with right. their imperialism, with their... Yeah.
And like, I'm thinking also about like the Chinese Exclusion Act, where they barred Chinese men except for a very small work quota. That's actually how I got some Chinese ancestry on my mother's side. And then, you know, the Page Act, which actually predates the Chinese Exclusion Act, where they actually barred all Asian women from migrating to the States under the assumption that all Asian women were sex workers. Mm. And like, that pairs up and it leads to so much of the modern day sexualized racism towards Asian women.
Yeah.
Like it's that ingrained in our country and it's that willfully erased from our history. So then like what I find also kind of disturbing is how a lot of these you know, news reports and things, especially in the stateside, will show a lot of these anti-Asian attacks, but only when the perpetrator or the attacker is black. And, you know, it has created this white mythology that black people are responsible for the mass portion of the recent wave of anti-Asian violence, which is not taken into account centuries of foreign policies, centuries of mass killings of Asian people by white people. And then there was this report that came out from the Virulent Hate Project, and they found that I believe it was like something like 5% of anti-Asian violence where race was confirmed was done by black people, but 89.6% was from white people. Yeah. And, you know, it's frustrating because I'm thinking about, you know, how Asians have been blamed or scapegoated for the pandemic. Black people are being blamed and scapegoated for white violence and white criminality.
Yeah, and also yes, there is definitely racism and colorism and all those things. Absolutely. In the Asian community. And but it's versa, also... Yeah. Something that I think is blown up, probably, just because, you know, it suits their agenda. It suits the white agenda.
Absolutely.
To keep us split, you know? Like,
yeah, they don't want another civil rights era. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we don't talk about is the Asian American contribution to civil rights. There are so many really just critical figures like Richard Aoki, Kiyoshi Kurumiya, who... I believe, if I remember correctly, also survived the Japanese internment, or the internment of Japanese Americans. And he was openly gay, and he marched with King on Selma, Dr. Martin Luther King. And he also was the one who looked after the kids when King was assassinated. 1970, he was the only openly gay panelist at the Black Panther Party convention. Yuri Kochiyama, who organized alongside Malcolm X. When Malcolm X was assassinated, she was the one who actually held him while he was dying. Grace Lee Boggs, who also organized with Martin Luther King in Detroit. It's in the Midwest. And she's also responsible for a lot of the public education for black communities. Like there literally are like schools that she helped build for black children. So like Asian Americans have been a huge part of civil rights, but none of this is being taught. You know, it's literally on purpose.
Have you noticed a difference in both communities, in the black, in the Asian, or any other communities?
Yeah.
Have you noticed a difference these past few years?
Yes. I think for some folks who are still stuck in this rat race, this struggle for power in a system that is built to oppress all of us, you know, some of them are still stuck in their ways. Some of them will not understand that my struggle is your struggle. We have the same oppressors. But I am actually seeing a lot of beautiful dialogue now, especially with the Blasian March. I will say pretty early on, we had a very small turnout for black people and a very large turnout for like Asian community members. And I think at first it was because anti-blackness is a very large conversation in Asian communities, in Asian circles. Anti-Asianness is not a conversation in black community. I mean, some folks just don't know, and you know, you don't know. It's not your fault that this system has taught you a certain way about how to perceive Asian people. And some people just don't want to learn. And that's not my problem anymore. Yeah. But this last Blasian March we had, so we have an annual Pride rally nowadays I'm too tired to do like so many protests anymore. I'm getting old. Oh my gosh. Gonna retire from the streets soon. But there was like a lot more black people, and I was very excited to see that. And I was very excited knowing that a lot more black organizers were like, how can we help? Let's do this. And I was like, oh, like people are starting to like get it. Mm-hmm. And like people are like hopping on and seeing like what's more important is that we find power in collectives, kind of like what Angela Davis was saying about solidarity. And what I'm also loving on, especially in Asian community, is that people are starting to really acknowledge that we black Asians exist. It's still like a struggle, but it's nice to know that folks are learning not to make us invisible, especially when, like, you know, Asians, we know how it feels to be invisible in the States. We know how it feels to be like, when you're talking about racism doesn't apply to you, you're basically white, which we are not. Seriously, lots of people in the States like think Asians are like white people because they think racism never happened to Asian people.
Yeah.
Like, that's how horribly mistreated or this miseducation runs.
You know? It's also like a very narrow way of defining Asians.
Thank you.
Which Asians?
Because which Asian?
Southeast Asians? Oh, not really.
Definitely not.
Like Middle Eastern people? Forget it. Like,
hello.
Do you know Guantanamo?
Thank you. I'm always thinking about, you know, 9/11 and how West Asians were treated, or like South Asians were treated because of that bias.
Yeah. So and like, they're definitely not white.
Like, yeah, absolutely. So it's been frustrating, but I'm glad to see that some people are starting to like, you know, understand.
That's what we're here for, right? To educate people.
Yeah, and I'm at the point where I'm like, look, climate catastrophe is here. We don't have time to squabble. So for me, the most important thing is building community across boundaries so that, you know, when we see another racial injustice crisis, or if what's happening in the South in the States and the massive flooding in the black neighborhoods like Jackson, Mississippi, if we already have those community networks, those connections established. Like Grace Lee Boggs, she said something along the lines of, it's not about critical mass, it's about critical connections. And I feel like we need those connections more than ever. We need those relationships across communities established more than ever. Like, we are on limited time with climate catastrophe.
Yeah, that's true. But also the realization that, hey, we're the majority.
We are.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the oppressed classes, the oppressed communities, we're the majority. It's just very few people with a lot of money and a lot of power.
Absolutely.
And they're making life hell for all of us. And we just also have to realize that, you know, we've got strength in numbers, and splitting into our different groups does not help us.
It helps them. It helps them, exactly. Like, I'm going to give a shout out to Rosemary Campbell Stevens, a Afro-Caribbean British political intellect who actually coined the term global majority. So there's been a lot of just mass deportations of specifically Southeast Asians, you know, to Vietnam, to Laos, these same countries that were impacted by U.S. imperialism. I mean, in my opinion, these people are in many forms refugees.
Yeah.
You know, refugees from the wars that the U.S. got involved with, the wars the U.S. caused, the political destabilization that the U.S. caused. And you will see, there's this one group, I believe it's called Asian Prisoner Support Committee. They've done a lot of awareness about how a lot of these Southeast Asian communities will, if they are, you know, if they are arrested, sent to prison to do a lot of the labor, they get deported. There was one case where a man was literally arrested, forced into prison for a long period of time. He helped fight a lot of the, you know, wildfires that were being spread because of climate catastrophe. And then instead of, you know, being like, oh, you know, you actually helped support this country, no, they deport him back to Vietnam. And we see how the prison industrial complex is creating, you know, a school to prison pipeline in Black communities, but in a lot of the Asian communities, it's creating a prison to deportation pipeline. You know, we are literally seeing the exact same entity oppressing us differently. Our struggles can be different, but there's so much similarity.
Yeah. And just a quick side note,